This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. President Bush now says the war in Afghanistan is moving into a dangerous phase for U.S. troops and the nation. The nation must prepare, he says, for casualties. The warning comes as more Marines are deployed to the region and evidence mounts that the ground war will escalate. In this hour, examining the war's next phase, where should the United States go from here? After a weekend of stunning retreats, the Taliban today suffered another defeat. U.S. Marines have taken an airstrip in southern Afghanistan. It's the first encampment of U.S. troops on Afghan territory in the fight. While the Marines faced no Afghan resistance, talks on the future of Afghanistan will face plenty of it when more than 30 Afghan leaders sit down at the negotiating table in Germany tomorrow. Behind the bright smiles of the Northern Alliance forces, our next guest, foreign correspondent Robert Fisk, paints a darker picture of blood, tears, and terror in Afghanistan, a war, he calls it, of God against technology. What has the United States accomplished so far in this war? With all the apparent successes of the military campaign, how is the political campaign and the battle for peace and security faring? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With us from Quetta, Pakistan, where it is very early in the morning, is Robert Fisk. He's Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Robert Fisk, you're our hero for getting up at this hour to be with us. Thanks for being here.
I don't feel very heroic at this hour, but it's a pleasure. How are you?
We're well, thank you. And with us in the studio is tonight's guest analyst, Robert Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary, co-founder of the American Prospect magazine, and a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University. Hello, Robert Reich.
Good evening, Tom.
So, Robert Fisk, the view back here, the news, sounds sort of like a rolling triumphs on the war front. How does it look to you?
Well, I'm afraid it looks as if what this war has done and what the United States and Britain have done by initiating it, although, of course, the actual war was initiated by those who committed the crimes against humanity on the September the 11th,
mm-hmm.
What it's done has restarted the Afghanistan Civil War. Although it was petering on between the Northern Alliance and a very small area of Afghanistan and the Taliban, a full-scale civil war between Afghans has now been underway for about a month, and countless hundreds, I'm sorry to say, we must be talking now about countless thousands of Afghans, have died. Some of them, of course, have been under arms, and if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. But many, many hundreds, and again, I fear, probably now thousands of civilians have also died. These were innocent people, as innocent as those who died in the World Trade Center and in Washington.
But Robert Fisk, we're given the impression
in Pennsylvania.
Robert Fisk, we get the impression at this end that what you describe as a restart of the Civil War is a kind of transitory fluidity on the way to some new and better political balance. You don't buy it?
No, of course not. Look, the Northern Alliance, who are supposed to be our allies, our foot soldiers, who are basically doing the shooting and dying so far.
Mm-hmm.
As you've just pointed out, virtually no American has been killed, and we hope not. We hope no other person is killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an American life does equal the same as an Afghan life. The Northern Alliance have a history of butchery, executions, and sex slave scandals. These are not good people. Many of them, including Rashid Dostum, with whom General Franks was having conversations, are war criminals. People who have tied human beings to tank tracks, as Dostum did indeed a few years ago, and driven them round barrack squares until they've been turned into mincemeat. Now, I'm not satisfied as a human being that when I hear Dick Cheney say, oh, well, we may have to be allied with people we wouldn't want to have as our neighbors, this is good enough. What is going on in Afghanistan at the moment, what happened in Kunduz, what has certainly happened in Mazar-i-Sharif, is that executions have been carried out on a fairly vicious scale against Taliban personnel by Afghan Northern Alliance personnel. We know that executions took place at the prison attempted breakout, the prison riot, if that's the right word for it, but both sides were armed 3 days ago. We're talking here about war crimes which are being carried out in our name. Now, that is not a new kind of war. That's an old medieval kind of war, and we are involved in it. Britain involved like a puppy dog with 100 soldiers, and America with now many more soldiers and an awful lot of personnel in the Air Force and the Navy. Navy are being contaminated by war crimes. And the most serious issue for me is that we're throwing away all our laws of war.
Robert Fisk, we hear, and there's been some debate about the fate of non-Afghan fighters in Kunduz, and we've listened with concern to reports out of Mazar-e-Sharif and the bombing of the prison there, but these have not been generally presented as war crimes in the American press, and certainly not by American officials.
Nor in television. I noticed in a CNN report in the last 24 hours a casual mention of executions of prisoners who tried to escape at Mazar way into the story. Now, was this the other way round? Were these Americans trying to escape from a prison where they'd been wickedly held by the Taliban? Executions would have been at the top of the story, and we'd be talking about war crimes for those responsible, and rightly so. Look, it seems to me from this advantage point, or perhaps disadvantage point, that something very, very wrong is going on here. After the First and Second World Wars, we Westerners, particularly after the Second World War, we built up rafts of legislation against war crimes. We set up war crimes tribunals. We set up Geneva Conventions. We set up the Nuremberg Tribunal. Our intention was to teach the rest of the world from our own folly and tragedy in two world wars in the last century that they must adopt a new morality, that we've got to stop mass rape, ethnic cleansing, murder, executions, secret crime, secret trials. These must end. This was part of the dark part of our modern world. And we lectured the Third World about this. We lectured the Chinese about it, the Africans, the Congolese, the Arabs. We were so strong in our morality when telling other people that the days of executions and killing and bloodletting were over. We did exactly the same to the Bosnians, the Croatians, the Kosovans, the Serbians. And suddenly, when we Westerners are attacked viciously and wickedly, and our glittering buildings are smashed, we throw away all the Geneva Conventions, we no longer care, we set up secret military courts, we're talking about death squads, but we don't use the phrase, we drop the word executions into our news reports. What we're doing now, in front of the Third World, or the developing world, or Africa, or Asia, or whatever you like to call it, is showing that when we are attacked, all the language we've spoken, all the lectures we've given about morality and Geneva Conventions and fairness and decency and being different from the others is all thrown away. And when I look back now as a human being, not just as a journalist, but I'm both, and I hear that Mr. Bush says you're against us or you're with us, well, I sure as hell aren't with Bin Laden, but I'm not with Mr. Bush. And if that means I'm against him, so be it. I can promise you an awful lot of other decent Westerners are.
We're talking with Robert Fisk, longtime Middle East correspondent, and now for The Independent. He's talking to us from Quetta, Pakistan. We're looking at the war effort in Afghanistan. How is the war really going? Are you comforted by the war news out of Afghanistan? What news would make you feel safer? And what do you make of Robert Fisk's accusation here that we are committing war crimes in Afghanistan? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Fisk, you always come at these issues with such passion, but give us the bill of particulars behind this accusation of war crimes. You've mentioned the prisoners in Mazar-e-Sharif, where what we've heard and read in the news is that there was some kind of armed breakout attempt and that there was a pitched battle to try and subdue the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters there. You may not agree with that interpretation, but that's only one. What else falls into your war crimes category?
Well, we do know that Mazar-e-Sharif, after the surrender, there was a continuing shootout between apparently Pashtun Pakistani, as opposed to Pashtun Afghan fighters, and the Northern Alliance.
You're talking 2 weeks ago there.
Yes, that's right. Now, there is very credible evidence, and to its credit, because I'm a great critic of the magazine, Time Magazine's correspondent did a lot of very detailed and excellent work there. It appears that at least 100 men who had surrendered were later lined up and shot dead. That is to say, executed World War II style, by the Northern Alliance, which, of course, we have to add, is being assisted by U.S. Special Forces and by the U.S. Air Force. Now, these men, some of the men who were being shot, ran back to their guns and tried fighting and were shot down again. Of course, we know this is a vicious and cruel war in Afghanistan. We know that this war, fueled by our weapons, by the way, and our encouragement over the past 22 years when the Afghans were fighting the Russians, has produced war crimes aplenty over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But when we involve ourselves in a war, we have to take our moral responsibilities as well. In normal circumstances, your president would be lecturing us about our moral responsibilities and the allies we keep. And now we have at Kunduz further reports coming out. This morning's, or rather tomorrow morning's in US time, London Independent has front page evidence by our correspondent Justin Hudler of further executions of Taliban by Northern Alliance fighters in the north. Don't tell me your special forces don't know this is happening. But either they don't try to stop it, or they don't particularly care, or they're powerless to do so, in which case, what are we as the West, and you particularly as Americans, doing allying yourselves with the Northern Alliance?
Robert Fisk, stand by. I want to put your general case to our guest analyst tonight, Robert Reich. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Fisk says we're rolling out war crimes in Afghanistan. What do you think? And Robert Reich, what about this case?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the degree of control we have over the Northern Alliance, and here is the bind we're in. Either we do have control over the Northern Alliance, in which case we may be complicit in war crimes, as Robert Fisk says, or we do not have control, in which case we don't stand a chance of establishing a new multi-ethnic government beginning tomorrow. I'd be very curious, Robert Fisk, your expectation with regard to those talks that start tomorrow in Germany. Do we have enough control over the Northern Alliance to basically tell them to just stop it and give way and embrace other tribes that they are at civil war with?
Thank you, Mr. Reich. Very good point, actually. Look, I think there are two things. I'd have to admit, first of all, as a journalist on the ground, that I've just been inside Kandahar province in the last 36 hours, rather like soldiers, and something I definitely don't want to be and never will be in my life. When you're on the ground, all you know about is what's going on in the 15 meters around you, and Bonn seems an awful long way away out here. But let me give a different and slightly broader response to that question. Look, I think the point is that the Northern Alliance is not a political party. It is not a friendly little militia group whom we happen to have bumped into, which holds the same morality and wishes as we do. When the Northern Alliance had 4 years from 1992 to 1996 in Kabul to show it could be a responsible government under Rabbani, the same man who claims he's president now, they killed 50,000 people in Kabul, many of them Pashtuns, whom they are now ostentatiously announcing they would like to have in their government. One of the most defining factors of the Northern Alliance, and indeed the Taliban, let's not get mushy-eyed about the Taliban because they happen to be the chief victims of the Northern Alliance at the moment, is that they will make the most extraordinary, the most honorable, the most outrageous promises and break them afterwards. My experience is, or at least my feeling is, based on my own experience, and I've been in Afghanistan a lot of times, that these people, that we will persuade these people, and they won't need much persuading, to make the most conciliatory, the most democratic, the most wonderful statements in Bonn. We will do our best to produce every tiny Pashto warlord to equal the balance, the Northern Alliance, of course, being chiefly Uzbek, Hazara, and Tajik, rather than members of the largest minority Pashto population of Afghanistan. We're talking there 38-40% of the country, and they will make these statements, and the European Union, which of course is hosting the conference, will clap, and the Americans will produce their usual spokesman at the Pentagon, White House, State Department to say this is a great step forward for a new Afghanistan, and they'll then go back to Afghanistan, and we'll see the continuation of what in any other war we would indeed be describing as war crimes. Do we control the Northern Alliance? I don't think we want to control the Northern Alliance, but we want to use them, and U.S. Special Forces are with them, standing among them, driving among them, using their radios. They've been seen by our correspondents to call in airstrikes on their behalf. And it's not good enough to say, if we don't control them, we may not be committing war crimes. Remember that during the Second World War, a large number of vicious atrocities were carried out against Serbs and Jews by the Croatian Ustashi militia in Croatia and in Bosnia and in parts of Serbia. And the Nazis, the German occupation forces, pleaded at the end of the war, that they were not responsible. They were with them but couldn't control them.
Robert Fisk, stand by. We've got to take a quick break at this end.
Yeah,
Robert Fisk, we have to take a quick break at this end. Callers, and there are a lot of you. We know you're there. Stand by. We'll take your calls right after the break. We're talking with Robert Fisk about the real situation of the war in Afghanistan. Are we making progress toward new stability, or have we sparked a new civil war? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the state of the war in Afghanistan. We get a picture from the Pentagon and the U.S. media. We're getting another picture tonight from Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent and a longtime British observer of politics and war in the Middle East. He's been covering it since the 1970s. He joins us in the middle of the night. And thank you again for that, Robert Fisk, from Quetta, Pakistan. We're also with Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, and with a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's go straight to them if we can. Peter is on the line. Welcome, Peter.
I'm very surprised that Robert Fisk does not recognize precisely what the atrocities of the Taliban. In his discussion, he seems to rather gloss over it, although he offers a few kind of, he seems to offer some recognition of what they did. But, for example, the massacre of the Hazaras in, I believe it was, in or around Herat, there were the obvious...
Mazar-i-Sharif it was, yes.
For the Hazaras? I don't believe the Hazaras are there. I believe they are in a different part of the country.
But we
there
take...
are Hazaras at Mazar-i-Sharif, I promise you, but carry on.
Okay, and I unless everything I have seen and read and learned from Afghani refugees around here, if they're all telling me falsehoods, they are all absolutely delighted that the Taliban have been overthrown. Not all of them support. Some of them are doubtful about the Northern Alliance, as are all of us. But, you know, in World War II, we made an alliance with Stalin against Hitler, and it was, of course, the right thing to do. In this case, I think that Fisk, who you need to have a kind of warning label on this particular journalist, who would never find anything right that the United States did. He has a long record in reporting on the Middle East on this, and I'm absolutely appalled that you continue to call on him. But that's all.
Peter, we thank you for your call. We call on Robert Fisk because he stretches our view, and we welcome that stretching. We want to see things from all perspectives here. But Robert Fisk, what about Peter's complaint that here you're giving a lot of... A lot of ire to the alleged missteps of the U.S. and its allies there and glossing over the Taliban's not very pretty record?
Right. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Peter for the personal abuse which he made, which is quite common these days for any mainstream journalist who doesn't agree with the American point of view. I've never glossed over the Taliban. I've reported on their atrocities. Indeed, my newspaper, under my byline, was reporting the atrocities around Mazar-i-Sharif and the mass graves which were found, which they created, before the American press. Either Peter doesn't know this or doesn't wish you to know it on your program. Mm. The problem is this. There are no good guys in Afghanistan. I have never glossed over the Taliban, but the fact that I have to deny that as if I'm in a court is part of the problem for all journalists who try to tell the whole truth instead of just the Pentagon or the State Department version of it. The Taliban, we know, are guilty of gross human rights abuses, particularly against women. Their gross attitude towards anyone who opposed them, even Pashtuns. We know that they were perfectly capable and indeed did execute Pashtun guerrilla leaders who attempted to rise up against them even in the last few weeks after this war began. But this is not the point. If we are indulging in assisting people who are war criminals against other war criminals, if that's what the Taliban are, and I certainly believe that elements of the Taliban, certainly in the north, have been war criminals. There's mm-hmm. no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going to do that, we're involved in a civil war, and we are indeed complicit in war crimes. And what is happening at the moment, and why my arguments are so dangerous to people like Peter, is that we are throwing away all the legal forest of legality that we set up after two world wars, teaching the rest of the world how to behave in time of war if there must be conflicts, because this time we have been hurt, we have been struck, and therefore our morality doesn't count anymore. we'll lash out and lash back. That is the real problem at the moment. It's not a question of attacking individual journalists for saying that. That's par for the course these days, and it has been for a long time if you buck U.S. foreign policy. But I'm sorry, there is an increasing number of people, and I know this through readers whose letters are printed in our newspaper, messages which I'm getting, conversations with Western diplomats off the record, of course, that there is deep and growing unease in this bit of the West, i.e. Europe. I'm not in Europe now, but I am a European, as opposed to the United States, about what is happening. And I'm not surprised that there are growing rifts between the British government, which was very quick to go yap to Mr. Bush, and the Americans over what's going on, because the British themselves are very concerned about these very issues.
Robert Fisk, stand by. I want to bring Robert Reich in. What about Robert Fisk's point? Robert Reich, do you see the United States and Britain suspending our better judgment here, our appreciation for international law, in a rage and fear about the terror attacks of September 11th?
I don't think the issue is so much rage and fear. Obviously, if Robert Fisk's allegations are true, there's going to have to be a lot of explaining at some point with regard to American complicity. But the bottom line, the real issue that I'd wish he would address, and I'm very interested in his responses to this question, are we getting closer to our goal, which is reducing the risk of global terrorism? I mean, the bottom line here, and I hate to use a sort of an American phrase, the bottom line, that's what we all say in this country,
yes, we do.
Robert Fisk, but the whole purpose of us being there, after all, is to make the world a little bit safer. And what you seem to be saying, or certainly you seem to be suggesting, is that we are not really getting any closer to that goal. Now, that's not what we're being told here in the United States. Here in the United States, it looks like we are not only winning the war against the Taliban, but more importantly, getting closer to rooting out al-Qaeda.
Robert Fisk?
Well, look, I've listened to the language of rooting out and making the world safer from the Israelis for the past 25 years, and their tactics, which also include death squads, of course, don't succeed and haven't done. Israel has never been so insecure as it is at the moment, tragically. Look, here's the situation as far as I see it at the moment. Bin Laden, I suspect, if he was responsible for September the 11th, and I suspect he probably was, I think he wanted American involvement in Afghanistan. I think he desired it. He is a man who clearly thinks very long term. He had said on numerous occasions, and indeed he said it to me personally in Afghanistan only 4 years ago, that his greatest victory was over the Russians in Afghanistan. And he hoped and prayed to God that he could have a similar victory over America, or as he put it in chilling words to me, that he could change the face of America. I think he probably wanted the Americans in. I don't think for a moment he thought that the Americans would use the Northern Alliance, or indeed that the Taliban would collapse at such speed. But equally, I think he wanted American ground troops in, and they're in now. Where is he? What is he doing? I don't know, of course, but I rather suspect he must be deeply shocked by what's happened. Is the West, or let's be blunt about it, is America, because this is not a coalition war. There are no German aircraft. Indeed, there are no British aircraft in the skies over Afghanistan. Is the American war achieving its aims? In the shortest possible term, yes. In the longest term, absolutely not. Not just these executions which are going on, and will indeed continue, and will continue for weeks to come, are sowing, but also the whole general war itself and the massive civilian casualties, are sowing the seeds of great hatred among many, many other people, young men and young women. There's no inequality of revulsion at war among different sexes. And you cannot stop terrorism by going to war with the most sophisticated weapons against, at the end of the day, the poorest and most broken country in the world.
Robert Fisk, Robert Fisk, we see the television images of streets full of celebrating people receiving troops as they come into Kabul and elsewhere.
Look, I have never covered a war in the Middle East in 25 years in which the winners haven't been greeted with smiles and rose water, rice, petals, free food, newspapers and money. I'm sure the people of Kabul were genuine. This was not the so-called spontaneous celebration when the Russians arrived, which I was forced to watch in 1979-1980. These are people who are genuinely happy. Of course, they've got rid of the Taliban. They have new masters. But those masters are going, I am sure, to behave just like they did before. When they do, the people of Kabul will wait for new liberators. What the people of Kabul wanted, of course, was American liberators, and later, no doubt, they'd turn against them. The history of Afghanistan, a cemetery of foreign armies, has always been one of new liberators being greeted in the streets and then turned against, because the Afghans don't want foreigners. But you see, the problem is that Afghanistan is not really a country. It's not a nation we're involved in. It's a set of tribal areas, as Mr. Reich knows himself, and as Peter apparently knows. It's a group of Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazaras, Pashtus, and other groups as well, all of whom go along with the fiction of Afghanistan because it helps, well, it used to help to keep the roads running and the electricity running. But it's not a real and genuine nation state. One of the whole issues here, which doesn't come across in American press and television, for example, is that the Pashto people extend way across the border into Pakistan. In most cases, there are more Uzbeks in Uzbekistan than there are, for example, in Afghanistan. There are more Tajiks in Tajikistan than there are Tajiks in Afghanistan. There are more Pashtus in Pakistan than there are inside Afghanistan. This leads us to a point where many Pashto people in Pakistan go off to support their cousins, brothers, nephews, whatever. And then, of course, if they're captured, we call them foreigners because they're from Pakistan and have Pakistani passports. They see themselves as being fellow Pashtus, not as allies of the Taliban, but allies of their own tribal ethnic people. And we're completely disregarding this. You wait, and I'll tell you that within 1 year, there will not be smiles in the streets of Kabul. Not because we've done it wrong or the Northern Alliance are worse than the Taliban, but because they're just the same.
Robert Fisk, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent, for an alternate view of what's going on in Afghanistan. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Rory is on the line. Hi, Rory.
Hi there. First of all, kudos to Mr. Fisk and NPR as well, about time, and my utter disappointment at Mr. Reich's response or understanding of the foreign affairs, i.e., his naivety in terms of seeing whatever on TV and believing it wholeheartedly. That's pretty naive of him, and I'm pretty disappointed by him.
He may be a bit more skeptical than you think, but what's your question, Rory?
Well, I'm coming to my question. Just give me a second.
You've got it, my friend.
Well, I'm saying that this is to be expected. If you look at the history of Afghanistan, I mean, forget the tribes or other nationalities. Even brothers, and after defeating foreigners, ended up turning on each other and turning into
how about a question, Rory?
Could I make a comment? Is that allowed? Well, the question is, my suggestion is we need to take a longer view on the history. My question is, if U.S. did not go into Afghanistan in early 79, there would be no Russian invasion, A. B, if that didn't happen, the country would not falter. C, Pakistan would have not turned into a bonanza state. And D, it wouldn't have come back to haunt us. So it's about time that we start taking the longer view on the history and start acknowledging our mistake. And last comment is that instead of sidelining the silent majority Muslim population in the entire world, we need to do or listen to their legitimate gripes at least, which each and every, like 99.99%, I read a lot of newspaper from all over the world and so on and so forth. One thing they all agree with is there should be a Palestinian state, A, and B, Jerusalem should belong to Muslim. If not, it should be an international city. But Muslim,
Rory, we got your call. I want to put the fundamental point. Thank you very much, Rory, for calling. But Robert Fisk, Rory asked us to take the long view, and I'm sure that anyone listening to your comments also wants to ask you, long view, how do we fix this? Okay, Afghanistan's not a country in a traditional sense of what a country is, and you're not happy about the way the war's being prosecuted, but we've clearly got to do something. What should it be?
Well, I think, first of all, it's necessary to point something out, a very gross inaccuracy in what Rory said. Americans were not in Afghanistan in 1979. The Russians came in to prop up a petty and vicious little dictator in 79. The problem with the Americans is that they were not in a position then even to give serious economic help, or if they could, they were outweighed by the Russians. This is a Cold War story. And while I'm deeply critical of many elements of U.S. foreign policy, the facts of history have to be presented as they actually were. Our folly was that we poured weapons into Afghanistan to be used against the Russians, and we supported many of the people who are now in the Taliban, as well as people who are now in the Northern Alliance, as well, indeed, and here we come again, as a certain Osama bin Laden, because we wanted them to fight the Russians.
Mm.
Once they'd fought the Russians and got them out, instead of coming in and massively rebuilding Afghanistan, pouring in money for roads, bridges, creating a railway network. There's never been a railway train in Afghanistan, for heaven's sakes. There isn't a single meter of railway track, except actually a single old steam locomotive handed over to the king of Afghanistan by the Kaiser 2 centuries ago. We didn't do that. We didn't care. We said, thank you very much. We've seen your country destroyed. There are 20 million landmines, 20 kids getting blown up every day, and there still are, by the way. We're off.
Okay, mea culpa, but here we are.
Well, suddenly, we love Afghanistan again. We love them. We want to liberate them. We want to free them from the awful Taliban, even though at one point the Taliban were negotiating with UNICAL, the American oil conglomerate, as well as the Northern Alliance. They were doing the same thing. Indeed, Taliban were going to America, by the way, in their black turbans to be received there, in order to set up a gas pipeline from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, down to Pakistan, through Afghanistan, crossing the front lines. But let me just add one more thing. You're talking about the crowds in the streets, and we know that kids can fly kites again, you can go to the cinema, you can listen to music, women can take off their burqas, most of them are not, but they can, and women can get jobs back at the television. But let's just remember something. We didn't involve ourselves in the Afghan war to let kids fly kites. We're not there because we want to liberate women. We may like the idea, we may say that's part of the reason, but it's not. We're not there to open cinemas or to allow people to listen to music. We're there for one reason and one reason only, and that's to get Osama bin Laden and the Arabs and other fighters around him. We're not going to liberate Afghanistan, and in our particular crusade, and that is indeed what it is, Mr. Bush got it right, though he didn't realize it, we are committing ourselves to allies, and indeed we'll have more allies very soon, who are carrying out the most unconscionable crimes, because these things happen in Afghanistan. If we wish to avoid this, and this is the real issue, we could have staged a serious military operation which involved tens of thousands of our own people. But we didn't want to do that. Outraged as we were by the crimes against humanity of September the 11th, we still maintain the post-Second World, or certainly post-Vietnam theory. Our guys don't die in wars. Other people do. We'll use the KLA in Kosovo. We're very happy if other people will die fighting our wars and be our foot soldiers, but we've got to try and keep our casualties down because we're a little bit more precious. Our lives matter more than other people's lives, and that lies, I'm sorry to say, at the heart of a lot of these problems.
Robert Fisk, stand by. We're going to a break soon, but I want to turn to Robert Reich first. Well, here's a long bill of accusations, Robert Reich. I'm not sure where to begin, but do you think we really would have been better off putting in thousands, tens of thousands of our own troops in lieu of the Northern Alliance?
Well, I don't think so. I think that Robert Fisk is correct in the sense that what we ought to do now, once we get rid of the Taliban, assuming we can, is not do what we essentially did in 1989 and wash our hands of Afghanistan, but instead do what it looks as though the administration is trying to do. Colin Powell has talked about a massive rebuilding program. We are trying to embrace something that we turned our backs on before, and that was nation building. Despite the Bush administration's statement that it's not going to be involved in nation building, we are. Indeed, that's what's happening tomorrow. We are going to try to engage in nation building. And the combination of pouring a lot of money into that society, creating an infrastructure there, and also at least make an attempt at nation building may help over the long term to reduce the incidence and probability that that is going to be a pressure cooker for terrorism. That must be the ultimate goal.
Stand by Robert Reich and Robert Fisk in Quetta, Pakistan. We're talking about the situation on the ground in the war in Afghanistan. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Robert Fisk, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. He's in Quetta, Pakistan, and he's not happy with what he sees in the war in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Ram is on the line. Welcome, Ram. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Ram.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Mr. Faiz and Mr. Reich, what is your opinion of Pakistan's involvement here? Pakistan seems to be the only nation who has benefited out of this whole crisis. I mean, look at the sanctions that has been taken off. Look at the money they have gotten. Probably they would have invested about $50 million in growing Taliban, and look at like they've gotten like almost closer to $2 billion, I believe. What's your view?
Ram, I'm going to take your question and go right to Robert Fisk. Our time is running down, but Robert Fisk, how is Pakistan faring out of all this?
Well, it thought it was faring pretty well. Sanctions lifted, IMF being very nice to it, a lot of American money coming in and support. It turned against the Taliban, which it helped to create financially, theologically, in every other way, which was in fact a creation of the ISI, the Pakistan Intelligence Service. And it believed the Americans, when the Americans said the Northern Alliance wouldn't be allowed to go to Kabul, which is very much a Pashto city and certainly a very large number of Pashtuns, suddenly the Northern Alliance went to Kabul and the Pakistanis were outraged. They said, hold on a minute, the word has been broken. Well, surprise, surprise, that happens in Afghanistan. A lot of people in Pakistan are asking what's going to happen to the government, but so far, and it has to be pointed out factually, President Musharraf said he'd face down the extremists, as he put it, the people who come on the street support the Taliban, support Osama bin Laden. He did, and their demonstrations are diminishing in size.
Robert Fisk, I want to go. We only have a couple minutes left. We've heard your outrage in this hour at some of what's going on the ground in Afghanistan. We appreciate the mind-expanding quality of it, but we really need to hear from you on the ground in practical terms. What should the U.S. do now to bring this to the best solution that's practical?
Look, this is an unsatisfactory reply for you because, indeed, I am on the ground, and I am in various wars over 25 years on the ground. We always have the same scenario. We carry out a series of policies which are absolutely abysmal and folly in the Middle East region. Then when it explodes, and it is pointed out that it is the result of our own folly, we say, yeah, we know that, but what would you do now? When Saddam went into Kuwait, etc., yeah, we don't want to hear about how we supported Kuwait, which indeed we did, the Brits too, by the way. Mm. We want to hear about what we do now. And I'm sorry, this is about history as well as the present. The answer is, we are at this stage of impossible moral quandary because of what we did. It isn't a question of can we fix it right now. If you smoke cigarettes for a long time and you get cancer, there's no point in saying, well, what do we do now? We have to look back. The best we can do now is say, how did we bring this appalling situation about? How is it that a man like bin Laden, just a single guy, can suddenly be so popular among so many Muslims and can have such power? It's not because he lives in a cave. It's not because he flies airplanes into buildings, if indeed he did, and it was a grotesquely wicked act. It's because he says things. Indeed, Rory mentioned this about Palestine, about Israel, about Iraqi sanctions on Iraq, children dying, foreign forces in Saudi Arabia, that he catches something which people object to profoundly in the region against America. This is not me talking. I'm explaining to you what many people here think. I'm just a street reporter. I work. I'm a mainstream newspaper reporter. But we need to find out and address these issues. It's interesting that in all your program tonight, no other Middle East issue has come up. But this is about other Middle East issues, and we should recognize it. When we do that, we're on the way to successful results and a fairer U.S. foreign policy, and perhaps no more wars, no more acts of terrorism by any side. But, you know, we've got to discuss that. We don't discuss it. The mere fact that when I started to on this program tonight, the first caller you got abused me personally. That is the problem with American journalism at the moment.
Robert Fisk, we thank you for climbing out of bed in the middle of the night in Quetta, Pakistan, to share your view with us.
I'm still in bed. Believe me, I'm still sitting in bed.
All right. Well, sweet dreams and back to it. Thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Robert Fisk is Middle East correspondent for The Independent, a British newspaper out of London. Robert Reich, there's a fiery denunciation of where we are and no willingness to give us an easy roadmap ahead, but saying, consider what you've done.
Well, a kind of resigned, very pessimistic view. I think it's worth hearing, but it doesn't help us very much now. I mean, the question is, what do we do now? We talked about a little bit during the program what Colin Powell and others in the administration are trying to do in terms of nation building. I think that's the right track. What is exactly the relationship between getting rid of the Taliban, replacing the Taliban with a more humane government, and finding Osama bin Laden and rooting out terrorism? I think that needs to be explored. Our press has got to explore those precise relationships. And also taking a wider view of the Middle East situation as a whole, forcing if we have to force the Israelis and the Palestinians to the peace table and to come up with some sort of solution with regard to setting up a Palestinian state, being tough with Egypt and Saudi Arabia with regard to their somewhat duplicity with regard to supporting us on one hand, but being very critical of us and fomenting or participating in fomenting a lot of anti-American sentiment in their countries. Look, this is all part of a vast jigsaw puzzle, but I don't think it does any good to simply throw up our hands and say we are like smokers who've smoked too much and we are doomed to die.
And yet, An Hour with Robert Fisk reminds us that there will not be any easy solutions to this situation.
No, we've got to define how we will know when we have won. And that is something the administration does need to explain to the American public.
Yet to come. Robert Reich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, fresh word from Afghan women. Dr. Lynn Amowitz from Physicians for Human Rights has just returned from Afghanistan, where she interviewed women in a camp for internally displaced persons near Kunduz. I asked her about their stories, their expectations for post-Taliban Afghanistan, and current conditions.
Certainly the conditions in Afghanistan now were worse because of the continuing war. However, the difference that was most striking was that people were more hopeful. At the time that I was there, cities had started to fall, the Taliban regime had lost some of its hold, and people were more able to go about their daily routine with ease.
Compared to earlier visits, you first went about a year and a half ago, and then again this spring. What did you see in terms of hope on those visits?
The visits that I had previously done a year and a half ago were both in Taliban-controlled areas and non-Taliban-controlled areas. At the start of the study, people were somewhat hopeful, but as the year progressed and as the study progressed, people had really bottomed out on their hopes for the future, basically.
You flew from Boston to Islamabad, down to Dubai, up to Tajikistan, and then drove in and ended up near Kunduz, which became famous during the siege that took place over the last few days. Paint a picture of it for us.
Where I was exactly was in an area called Noabad. It's south of Dashti Kala. It is one of the only river crossings between Tajikistan and Afghanistan. It's basically a pontoon run by a tractor that you hop on and go across. There are no roads. It is incredibly difficult to move about, but there are ways of getting to where you need to be. The area that I was specifically in, called Noabad, was an area where many of the internally displaced people, or those people that had fled the area of Kunduz and Tahar, and had now settled themselves to be away from the front line.
And what would have pushed them out of their homes, and how long have they been displaced inside Afghanistan?
Some of the women that I interviewed had been displaced for a year and a half previously when the Taliban had taken over Taliban. But there were also more new arrivals that, since the front line had moved a bit, they had fled to make sure that they were safe. And also they had fled because they had feared that their sons would be forced conscripted.
Were these mainly women in the camp, or were mainly simply women that you were speaking to?
I definitely sought out women to speak to, since women have very little voice in Afghanistan. But it was also striking that there were quite a few widows, more than the usual 20% that you expect to see in Afghanistan, primarily because they came from areas without health care, so husbands had died of things that normally would be treated in areas where there is health care, but also because their husbands had been taken to the front lines.
A lot of the people, the women in this camp, are living in holes in the ground. Is that right?
Many of the widows, because they are deeply steeped in tradition, would not necessarily access humanitarian assistance. They would not leave their tent without a male escort, and so they would not show up for an IDP card or a ration card. So they were living in holes because they had not been able to get a tent or blankets or food.
Take us inside the minds of the Afghan women that you've talked to, Lynn Amowitz. How do they see the world? What do they see now in the world?
The women that I interviewed are incredibly savvy. They talked about their hopes. They talked about what they had previous to the Taliban. They talked about what they had now. And they mainly wanted me to give them a voice, to say, please tell the world that these are the issues that are happening. I'm living in a hole. I'm eating beans cooked with salt and water. My children cry at night. I cry with them. These are the things that they told me.
So here you are. You're the megaphone. What are the issues that they want the world to know about?
They need food, shelter, housing. They were also concerned about schools for their girls or for their boys, as well as some accountability for the crimes that they had witnessed and had been victims of.
And what sort of crimes were those?
The forced conscription of their boys and their husbands, the killing
into of... Into what army?
It was both, actually. There were no really good guys in this group. The Northern Alliance, as well as the Taliban, mm-hmm. had forced conscripted boys and young men. And it was striking to see in the IDP camps that there were very few teenage boys around. But they also wanted people to know that even the old men and old women within the villages had been beaten, killed, thrown down wells, and sometimes hand-grenaded.
What was the point of this terror?
You know, I'm not even sure that you could ever give a point to any type of human rights abuse. Certainly it was to demoralize, to break down the community, to show who has power, and also to continue to hold power.
You talked about how many widows were among the internally displaced Afghans. What happens to a widow in Afghanistan?
It's very difficult for widows to function in Afghanistan, particularly if they are traditional. If they have a relative that is within their community, if they're not living in an IDP camp, but they're in their own community, then they're much better able to function and to go about their life.
Did the strict Islamic laws of the Taliban government make this problem of living as a widow even worse?
Certainly, if you were a widow under a Taliban regime, your life was worse. Although, not to ever give credit to the Taliban, they did lift some of their sanctions on widows, allowing them to access aid without a mahram or a male escort. And they did allow groups like CARE International to have a widow's bakery so that they could have a food for work program.
What did women say to you about the Taliban in general and those years under those strict strictures?
It was a horrible period in their life, that it remained a horrible period, that this was the reason that they were in these camps, and that they wanted them to disappear so that they could go back to their life. Although they also stated that 23 years of war, drought, and poverty were also concerns, not just the fact that the Taliban had been in power for 6 years.
Mm-hmm. But did you get the sense that the rules that the Taliban laid down were rules that were very foreign and unwelcome to these women, or were some of them simply Afghan tradition?
Some of the rules that the Taliban laid down are Afghan tradition, but our study actually showed that 98% of women and men did not agree with the Taliban policies that were set against women.
Did you have any way of looking at the mental health of the women you talked to who have lived under that regime?
We did. We did a mental health assessment, basically a depression scale, to look at how women were doing. And even in non-Taliban-controlled areas, women have high rates of depression, high rates of feeling like they want to kill themselves, and high rates of actually attempting to kill themselves.
So this is really attributable to the general chaos and disarray of the country over such a long time.
I think that their mental health problems are more than just Taliban policies. They're 23 years of war, poverty, drought, international isolation, and lack of basic needs.
But you say that you saw, and you're just a few days back from Afghanistan, you saw an attitude of hope now. What is the nature of that hope?
I think their hope is now seeing more aid coming in. The fact that the Taliban's repressive regime is going and that they will be able to move back to their villages. The one thing that was very concerning to them was the fact that they were living in a camp and not in their villages.
Lynn Emowitz, what have you learned from your studies in Afghanistan that should inform reconstruction efforts that lie ahead for that country?
What we've learned about the reconstruction efforts is that women would like to participate in these, and that both men and women feel that it's important to have women participating in society and in any decisions about health care, education, work, opportunities, government, and all of the rights that the human race has.
If you were in charge of nation building in Afghanistan starting now, where would you start?
The first thing is that all rights have to be restored for women as well as for men, to start with basic needs and to build from there.
Dr. Lynn Emowitz is with Physicians for Human Rights and on the faculty at Harvard Medical School.